In 1874, quite late, came the reform that had actually been talked about throughout the entire period, parts introduced in 1862 already, namely the military reform. In some ways, the core of what a lot of this was about. The Russian army at this point was restructured into a modern European army. First of all classes, not just the lower classes, were subject to call-up, though higher classes would serve as officers. Service was reduced dramatically from 25 years to only 6 years, and a regular reserve was created of those soldiers who had finished their service. All of this was very importantly connected to the end of serfdom. Under the old system, serfs were recruited as soldiers or sent as soldiers for 25 years. If they were lucky, they could be free if they survived that period. A modern army had to be based on a free population. If you changed the rules, created 6 years, and told everybody they were free, soon de facto serfdom would be ended. Indeed, people would be clamoring to be in the army. The end of serfdom and the creation of a modern army were connected. Clearly, these were dramatic reforms. But one needs to ask, what did they mean? What did they mean to the Tsar, to his advisors, to his subjects, to society as a whole? The first sign of trying to understand the meaning of these changes, the ideas behind them, is to look at the political personality of Alexander himself. By most accounts, he was a man who was really not a very likely candidate to become Russia's greatest reformer since Peter the Great. He lacked great zeal, the great drive that Peter the Great had. In fact, it's clear he didn't even have any real liberal convictions, the way, for example, Catherine II did, or even Alexander I. Indeed, until 1855, he had completely publicly supported everything his father was doing. On the other hand, it's clear from those who knew him that he wasn't a committed supporter of tradition for tradition's sake, the way Nicholas I was. In fact, some people said he had no ideas whatsoever. He was uncertain what to do. He simply inherited the job and tried to figure out what was best and most appropriate. And in fact, one sign of this is he often chose as ministers people with radically different points of view. He wanted to hear opposite points of view, perhaps because he was uncertain. In practice, in fact, his policies often fluctuated between reform and efforts to limit the effects of reform. One explanation is he, like so many before him, started out as a liberal and became increasingly conservative, especially when he was almost assassinated by a radical terrorist in 1866. Others would argue he didn't know what he believed, and hence the fluctuation. But a more interesting argument is that, in fact, there's a sort of commitment to ambivalence. That sounds paradoxical, but I'll try to explain what I mean by what might be seen as a logical contradictoriness in his policies. When one looks at reforms, and at the reformers and what they're saying, one sees a certain pattern. First of all, there's one clear goal, no question. Strengthen the state, strengthen the country, strengthen its military preparedness, strengthen its authority as a modern nation, in reality and in the eyes of the world. The problem was, complicating this, is ideas about strengthening, about modernization, had two faces, was sort of Janus-faced, one might say. On the one hand, they really understood the need for modernizing progress, and Alexander was convinced of this as the arguments were presented. One needs a state based on regular procedures. One needs people free, citizens free from all the many restrictions that had existed, so they would play an active role in public life, essential in every modern society existing in Europe. And this meant obviously ending serfdom, creating greater local administration, such as we've seen in the zemstvos and the city councils, and creating a modern army of free men. On the other hand, the other half of this formula for modernizing reform was what might be described as the logic of power, of modernizing power. One has to preserve, and you've heard this argument before, it was not new, one has to preserve the creative power that brought about all of these wonderful changes. One has to preserve the order that was needed for progress. In other words, balance power and progress, order and change, modernization and the traditions of autocracy. And to see what I mean, it's worth looking more closely at the reforms, because one sees this balancing act everywhere between power and progress.